there we are, folks. That's the beginning introduction of Won't Get Fooled Again by The Who. And we won't get fooled again by QuickTime, that is for sure. We recorded episode 8 last week and QuickTime totally screwed us over. And so do you know what? We're recording episode 8 again. I am Scotty from iDeveloper TV and with me is Mr. John Fox.
Hello, 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 everybody out there in net radio land. But while we won't be fooled again by using QuickTime again, the audience will have been fooled again by having to listen to the same broadcast as last week. So we should just probably point that out.
But if they're anything like me, they won't remember. I regularly listen to, I regularly listen to podcasts twice and I get about 40 minutes in and think, I think I might have heard this one.
Do you remember waking up and getting out of bed this morning?
I remember getting out of bed. I don't remember the waking up bit. John, last week we had a surprise guest. I guess this week is a bit less of a surprise.
No, he's still. It's still surprising. It's still surprising.
And what, we have none surprising, other than David. Surprising that he bothered to come back, you mean?
Well, given that it was his specific QuickTime audio stream that failed, I think it's only right.
It was him who screwed us over.
Name names, were we?
It was him who screwed us over.
I'm sorry. I hang my head in shame.
You better tell us who he is, John.
Okay, so Dave Spector is, as I think it's safe to call him, a Mac Greybeard, that he's been around the Mac market since the very, very earliest days in let's say, back to 1984, correct? Working with Macs for a long time, a long career in the financial services and Wall Street, a long career doing Mac development, a long career doing iOS development in the more recent years. So that's my little introduction, but he'll do a better job. Go ahead. David, tell us about yourself in 140 characters or less.
Ooh, well, I think I've already exhausted
8, 9,
that
10, 11, 12.
In our pre-show. Boop, there we go. Well, as you pointed out, I've got a long career doing all sorts of stuff in this business. My career doing stuff with machines made by Apple goes back, frighteningly, even farther than that, to my first software company in high school where I wrote inventory systems for local businesses. So, as you say, I've done this stuff for a while, been around a while. You know, the great thing, of course, about being in this business is that you're never done. There's always new stuff to learn, and there's always, you know, great people who are, especially in the, you know, in the indie Mac community, willing to teach you things. So that's, you know, that's what I love about it and what I look forward to every day. So thanks for having me back yet again. And again, I apologize for my QuickTime breakage, but now hopefully I've got enough, you know, redundant systems here that I won't let that happen again.
Yes, I believe, David, you are recording on at least 5 different streams today.
Yes, and probably on multiple computers too, with microphones and old-fashioned reel-to-reel recorders behind me, just to make absolutely sure.
And I believe you also have an assistant taking shorthand just in case.
Yes, that would be my lovely wife, Michelle, who was taking shorthand.
Right, okay, let's get into the news. John, give us some news music until we get some.
Teletop machine in the background.
There is absolutely no expense made on this show at all. Right, Steve Jobs gone on sick leave, and then Apple a couple of days later announcing the best quarter ever. Coincidence?
I don't think coincidence at all. I'm sure it was clearly planned, and I think that very well executed. But you know, since this news happened last week, I would point this thing out. There's a fellow named Derek Silvers who blogs at silvers.org, and he is the founder of CD Baby, which I think should be known by indie musicians out there in the world. They basically allowed anybody who could come up with a CD, even if they self-pressed, to get it sold through their very efficient inventory system. And they actually provided the mechanism for, you know, arbitrary indie bands to get on iTunes Music Store. So he's someone who I think who I respect a lot, who does interesting things, and he blogged just this past week about making yourself redundant. And I think it's actually rather apropos, because the question comes along with the news and the spectacular results is can Steve Jobs make himself redundant? So by basically making the organization that he's built up around him, the management team he's built up around him, able to execute on his vision in the way that he would. And I think, you know, the answer to that is for some time now they've been going on saying that there's a management team. It's not just one person. That you know, if you kind of look and see who's doing what, you have Jonathan Ive, you have Tim Cook, you have Phil Schiller, and they all have kind of, you know,
come together for some time have been executing very well. So while it's not possible that, you know, Steve Jobs is not replaceable as he is, the functions of what he's brought to the table sure seem to be, at least in portion, executable by other people that are there. So I don't know. What do you guys think?
I think you just, to me, sort of hit the nail on the head. I think on a day-to-day basis, Apple can survive without Steve Jobs probably forever because, I mean, I'm sure there's lots of very, very capable people. It's long-term vision for products and where the company goes. That where's that coming from next?
And I think the other thing too is the spokesmodel factor because there's no one, you know, there. I really can't think of all that many speakers in the whole industry that are anywhere as close to good as him. I mean, really. So.
Right. Well, I think there's a bigger issue at Apple that certainly not least to my outside observer's perspective recognized in the rest of the industry, which is that, you know, the management team at Apple seems to me, obviously as an outsider, I don't work for Apple. I obviously don't speak for them or never worked for them directly, but they seem to have bred a kind of manager that seems to me to be fundamentally different than other technology firms. And I've worked at a lot of them. I've worked at big firms, as you pointed out, on Wall Street. And a lot of management on Wall Street and elsewhere, and certainly technology firms, is the classic idea that we all had as kids of managers, right? That you don't necessarily do technical things, that you sort of are an overseer. But it seems to me, from the way I perceive Apple to be, is that managers at Apple across the board seem to be, you know, beyond the definition of hands-on, right? That these are people who are not sitting around waiting for other people to do things and just observing and critiquing and, you know, cheerleading the results. They seem to be nose to the grindstone, pushing the rocks up the hill with everybody else, and they seem to have to either grow or die at Apple. That you get good at it, you're going to be a good spokesperson for the company in terms of how you present the idea and grow yourself in multiple dimensions, or frankly, you're just not going to last there.
Well, here's something interesting. So Corndoggy Rob, and I'd like to know what his real name is. So Mr. Corndoggy Rob, please tell me what your real name is. But he brings up a very good point. He says that, you know, okay, any man is replaceable, but you know, there's cult aspect of it. So part of the thing about their news results in here, watch how I'm tying these things together. If their market share is increasing, and it certainly is, and it's coming from switchers, do you think that there's a larger percentage of Apple users that aren't cultist, right? I mean, because for numbers of years, in the darkest days, Apple survived because there was some critical mass of people who would refresh their machines and stick with it. But slowly but surely, starting with the release of iTunes for Windows and iPod taking off, is really when they started having large numbers of non-Apple fanboy users coming into the user base. And so the question I have is, how important is the cult of Steve Jobs to the Apple brand and the Apple mystique? Is it really Steve Jobs the man, or the Steve Jobs as kind of a tastemaker, but not the only one? You know, I mean, how much credit?
I think it's the latter. I think it's a Steve Jobs as design icon. But obviously, if Tim Cook, and, you know, eventually when Steve Jobs retires, or God forbid something terrible happens, I think that if they can make that transition where it's clear that Apple's design is good because Apple understands good design, and it's not just Steve Jobs as the final arbiter of that, it will continue. And people will realize that this is a company driven on an unbelievably exceptional engineering and the relentless pursuit of beautiful things because they are beautiful and do and work well, rather than just because they move at the whim of industry fashion.
Well said, I would say.
Well, thank you.
And let's not forget the results were fantastic, particularly with the Mac. The Mac side, I thought, was incredibly impressive. What was it? Was it 4-6 million, something like that? So that's a 4.6 million.
Yeah,
it was
more than four. I mean,
4.6 million Macs. Yeah, that's stunning. They grew. I think the number was 9%. They grew the industry 9%, where everyone else contracted across the board. So, to John's point, you know, the fact that now there are people who were on Windows who see this as just not just a beautiful device, but a better way to use information tools, is the key. Because at the end of the day, Steve Jobs has pointed out that no one really cares about computing per se. They care about the effect that computing has, right? You want to do the stuff. I don't really care. I don't care how my Prius, you know, works. I care that it's a good car, it saves money, it goes well, blah, 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 right?
I thought you liked the Prius is because it was the gangster mobile that you could, you know, you could do drive-by shootings and nobody could hear you because the engine made no noise.
Hey, we were going to keep that secret, man. Now the word's out.
Okay, quickly before they come for you, David, we'll move on with a seamless link. Okay, so the Macs are selling like mad, and we're just jumping all over the place in the schedule I sent you. We're now two weeks into the Mac App Store. What's the first opinions, guys?
I wouldn't know, because Memory Miner, embarrassingly, is not up there yet.
Drat.
Have you made a purchase from the App Store, though?
I have several.
To be perfectly honest, I haven't. I've looked through it, and I couldn't say that there was anything that I didn't already have. I didn't see anything that's like, oh, wow. You know, I mean, yes, there's the new, you know, Twitter 2.0, but I haven't switched to that because, I don't know. I don't dislove the one I'm having, you know.
Right. Truth be told, I actually haven't bought anything with actual cash dollars, but I have downloaded a bunch of free stuff because I think I'm in the same boat that you are, John, which is that probably most of the really important things, and frankly, or like, you know, iWork and so forth, I already own. So it doesn't make sense to give Apple that much more money for no reason.
Yeah, and I was a little miffed at having bought, you know, full pop, you know, iPhoto 11, because now I could have had it cheaper had I waited a week.
You see, I did make a purchase mainly because I wanted to see how it worked. And outside of it, and I just bought a little utility to clean up my address book, which actually worked quite well, just for a few bucks. But you know, what really struck me was it wasn't just that I could press a button, and I just love the way it animates down to the dock and all that. And for, you know, for your average Mac user, that's going to be fantastic. But actually, because it goes through your iTunes account and that's already set up, the act of purchasing didn't involve getting out a credit card or a PayPal account or anything. In fact, you know, it just took the entry of a password. And, you know, I think that stops one of the barriers people have to buying. When they get their wallet out and they find a card, they think again. When they go to the PayPal page, they think again. When it's just a password, it's like that's the only thing between you and the purchase, you and spending money. And I think actually that's a big plus for people selling through it.
Certainly. I think that Apple's finally actualized something that the telephone companies wanted to do back in the 90s. Back then, I was doing some work for Citigroup on the executive management team. And one of the big questions about this whole internet thing, which to them was very new back then, was how do we make all this payment so seamless that you never take out a credit card and you don't really... You know, there's no friction to the sale because you don't have to think, oh, wait a minute, I'm entering a credit card. Do I really want to do this? And Apple is now, certainly back into the, you know, the late 90s into the early 2000s, the phone companies wanted to do this with, you know, text to buy something, but it just wasn't seamless. And of course, now you have the iOS App Store and now the Mac App Store, and Apple's made that a reality. And you could probably easily get yourself in over your head because, you know, you really don't realize you're spending money until you see that email come back from Apple that, you know, confirming your purchase as a receipt. So it could be a slippery slope for some people, but I think it's just utterly brilliant in terms of its execution. It really is seamless.
Yeah, the only way to improve it is to make it so that all you have to do is think about it.
But that's going to be interesting as well by the fact that, you know, if you've just done that on the phone or the iPad and you've spent $5, $10, you sort of don't feel too bad about it. If you've just spent $79 or, you know, $100, and which you could quite easily do on the Mac App Store, you know, you can then think, oh, well, I didn't really want that. I wasn't quite sure I was doing that. And I'm just wondering how the whole refund and calls for that is going to end up going. But doesn't seem to be any complaints at the moment.
Okay, so I'm going to ask for fixed predictions on the panelists and people out there in the audience. Because, okay, we're now 2 weeks in, and there were a lot of discussion before it launched about it's nearly perfect for the reasons we just said, the seamless nature of it, but there are still kind of holdups. You know, there's no try before you buy. There's no way of migrating installed bases. Who here thinks that they're going to make any changes to their policies or are going to keep it exactly the way it is right now?
Who
Mr. Scotty, what do you say?
Do I think Apple is going to change anything about their policies?
Yep.
No. Not immediately, anyway.
Mr. Spector.
Wrong!
Not sure. I think that the whole try before you buy thing for any substantive app is really an issue because there's sort of, you know, there's this, I think we discussed this in our failed effort to record this last week, that there's kind of a bifurcated universe there, right? Which is for apps that are, you know, relatively expensive and not from unbelievably huge players like Microsoft or Adobe or people who charge you hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of dollars for their software, it's, you know, there's this split. How do you sort of deal with that? If you're an indie, you know, you the uptick in your sales because of the incredible distribution ease of purchase that Apple gives you might make it so that, well, okay, I'm going to get a lot more users anyway. But I think that that whole try before you buy thing for a lot of people, especially for software of impact, where, you know, you your business depends on it and you have to make a business decision about the software, will eventually, something's got to be done. I think Apple will figure it out.
Yeah. Well, I saw some fairly interesting discussions about people, you know, indies had to have, will ultimately have to make the decision, and some already have, about do they sell exclusively on the App Store or not. And, you know, Apple's official line is like, yeah, you want try before you buy? Great, put it on your website. So I can't think that there's anybody that says, you know, come to my website to get a trial version, and when you're done, go back and buy it for the Mac App Store. Actually, maybe that's not true. Maybe there is. Maybe the people that make Pixelmator have done that, since they announced they're doing, you know, App Store only. But, you know, some people have said, you know, that there's two. They're looking for a couple of things from the App Store. One is that they're simply, you know, looking for an awareness channel, especially given that they've killed the Mac software thing. It used to be that it was built into a menu item, and that they really pushed it, and then they stopped doing the menu item. And I believe they've even stopped, you know, the web pages still exist because they're Googleable, and not just in their cache, but, you know, there's no official Apple way to find out about apps other than the App Store. So for those people who are making kind of professional apps that do have costs, that do require evaluation, if nothing else, that you have to have some presence on the App Store to reasonably reach your customers. And then it's up to you to decide who makes the sale. Do you do it?
Well, that's an interesting point, John, because you said, you know, you have to have some presence in the store to reasonably reach your customers. But Apple's, you know, the guidelines, the Mac App Store are incredibly draconian in that, you know, no demoware. So that almost cuts that whole idea out. So they do have to figure something out about that. But I have to go back to another point you made, which is that, you know, people are sort of either, you know, sort of dropping their own stores completely, or doing the, you know, I'll keep my store, like Will Shipley and Delicious Monster, for example, have done what I think is an amazingly brilliant and, frankly, the right thing. I think when the store first started, and we won't mention any particular developers' names, one developer in particular released a version of their software on the store and basically said, well, this is the only place it's going to be. I know I promised an update to you via, you know, our regular mechanism, but sorry, not going to happen. And all heck broke loose on Twitter. This particular developer got roundly criticized. And I think, you know, what happened to them is probably sort of a good life lesson in that, you know what? There are new ways to do things, but your existing customers are your existing customers. They got you where you are. They're, you know, stick with the ones that brought you, support them. Whereas Will and Delicious Monster and a number of other developers have basically said, yeah, we're going to be on the App Store, but we're also going to support our other developers. We will always support you. You know, there may come a time we have a major version and number bump that we then are only on the store, but we will support you. And they're just incredibly vehement about it. And I think that, you know, bodes well for developers that do that, because it tells their customers, hey, you know what? We understand the rules of the game here. We love you. You are with us. We're not abandoning you. No way, no how.
Yep. As Koku Samurai makes a great comment, you know, don't promise anything new in versions of apps. That's I should listen to that as much as any other indie developer out there. You should just never talk about the future.
Oh, well, seeing Koku Samurai in the chat room, that's a great chance to move on to our next news item, because we're supposed to promote NS Conference at this point, NS Conference 2011 in the UK, March 21st to 23rd, but it sold out 4 days. Now, the reason I say Koku Samurai as a link, that's Colin Wheeler. He is one of our speakers at NS Conference, but so there's no point me promoting it. There's no point me trying to make you buy a ticket, because you can't get one, I'm afraid, because they've all gone. But, John, you do want to talk about your snark board.
I do want to talk about my snark board, and this might help with the liaison to our further discussion. But for a project that I did, I had to develop a kind of a flipping tile board, kind of like old-fashioned train stations where you have letters that flip through. And I was thinking to myself, okay, well, you know, it's great. I did it. I learned some things. And maybe I should make an app out of it. And I'm still thinking about wanting to do this thing, but I'm going to test it out. So because I've been to numerous conferences where they say, hey, you know, use this hashtag on Twitter. And I've even been to one conference where they set up an SMS account. And what they would do is in between speakers, they would reveal what people were SMSing. They would anonymize it so that you could see kind of a running commentary on it. And you know, me being the snark monster that I am, took great pleasure in taking pictures of the speaker with the snarky comments behind them, and I got some fairly clever ones. So I'm going to bring to NS Conference my little snark board thing, and so I'll just rearrange it a little bit so that its source of text will be a search on the NS Conference hashtag. And depending on what its reaction is, I may one day kind of turn it into a product that you can kind of skin the way that you look at the look and feel of the tiles and maybe the background, so that you can kind of simulate an old style kind of, you know, whatever London railroad station or something else, and also configure, you know, where you get the text from. But it will be the debut of the snark board.
Can't wait. Anyway, let's move on, because there's no point talking about something that people can't go to and just frustrate them. Right, okay. This next news item, do you know what? I think this may be one of the most important things to me I have ever done in my life, this next bit. And it's developers against poverty. I've been wrestling for some time now, about 6, 7, 8 months, about, you know, really doing something, getting the developer community together to make a difference in the world. And I've been trying to work out how to do it and the best way of doing it. And I've come up with something I want to do, and whether it's the best way, I have no idea, but this is what I'm going to try. And I've set up this thing called Developers Against Poverty, and basically it's a campaign that's going to run during February and March this year, 2011. And really, I'm just asking software developers from all over the world, no matter what your platform, your language, your background, whether you're indie, whether you're a permie, whether you're a consultant, even if you're a hobbyist programmer, I want us to come together and basically to raise $50,000. And that $50,000 will be used to ensure that 2,500 people will get clean water for the next 20 years. You know, as a developer, I've been through good times and bad times. You know, I've had times when I've had money, I've had no money, depending on how well products were doing or the job market was. You know, but I've always been able to go to the tap, turn it on and get clean water and just not even worry about it. But, you know, it shocks me that unsafe water and a lack of basic sanitation kill more people every year than every form of violence, including wars on the planet. Children particularly vulnerable because their bodies are more vulnerable to diarrhea and dysentery and other diseases. And in fact, 42,000 people die every single week because of a lack of water or basic sanitation. And of those 42,000, 90% of them are children under 5. And I think, you know, and the sad fact is that is totally preventable, because for just $20, you can give someone clean water for 20 years. I mean, not just by sending them bottled water, by putting a well in their village, putting a pump so they get clean water. I mean, some of the times these guys are walking miles every day just to get water and come back, and the water is disgusting. Now, I've been trying to work out a way of doing this. I don't want to start collecting money, go for charity registration, all that sort of stuff, because it gets in the way of everything. And so I looked at what charities are out there to support, and I've chosen to support a charity you may or may not heard of called Charity Water. They're going to be collecting all the donations on their sort of a campaign on their website. We've registered a campaign with them, so everyone will know that it's coming through Developers Against Poverty, that it's developers doing it. They'll be able to see how much we've raised. We'll be able to see how much we've raised. They're a non-profit organization that are really aimed at, totally, their only aim is to bring safe drinking water to people in developing nations. They've been around since 2006, done about 3,000 fresh water projects since then, which is great. But one of the reasons I went for these guys is there's a guarantee that 100% of the money that we collect will go to the projects. Nothing will go to administration. Nothing will go to advertising. Nothing will go towards fundraising. 100%. If we collect $50,000, then we know that $50,000 will go to clean water projects, because they fund themselves and fundraise and advertise through totally private donations, so that anything we give goes there. So I'm hoping that guys from around the world, are you going to join in? I haven't said it that you need to do this or need to do that on a certain day. I don't want to restrict it. Everybody's different. I want people to go out and be creative. At iDeveloper TV, we're going to choose 2 or 3 days across the period and just say, you know, those days are sales 100%. go to Developers Against Poverty. And if it's the best sales days we've had, then fantastic. Wouldn't be more happy. You may choose to just give a fixed amount. You may choose, if you're a consultant, to say, well, I'm going to give my fee on this particular day or a percentage of my fee. You may just want to stick your hand in your pocket and find $10. I don't care, but do something. That's the point. I don't care, but do something. Because, if you can go to your sink and just turn on the tap and get clean water, then you're better off than 1 billion people. And you can do something about it. There we are. I think that's probably far too long an advert. The campaign launches on the 1st of February. You can actually donate right now if you want to. But the website for registration to show that you're involved and whatever else will go live on the 1st of February, the address is developersagainstpoverty.org. Though I think developersagainstpoverty.com will get you there as well. Everything I've just said is on there. Follow on Twitter, Devs Against Pov, and you'll get all the information. Join the mailing list. But most importantly, give us your cash. Give us your cash. There we are. Do you think I sold that enough now, John?
You sold it enough, but you cannot sell it enough. I will say publicly, I think it's fantastic. I'm absolutely thrilled to support it. I'm familiar with Charity Water. Actually, there was lots of people do it, but one guy in particular who introduced me to it was Wave from Pixar, the guy who gives the talks at WWDC, where he basically says, "Hey, it's my birthday. I have everything I've ever wanted. I don't want gifts. Please make a donation in my name." I was very happy to do it, and I think it's great. So more power to you.
Excellent.
In fact, actually, what I want to know is, you might remember we gave an invitation to Justin Williams because he did the what was it called?
Was it Indie Relief?
Indie Relief. There we go. In support of Haiti, and I was one of a gazillion ones, and it became almost like a little competition on the day. I was hoping I saw going across on Twitter. So I hope that happens. That developers will take great pride in how successful they are in raising money for this day. But Justin, when you develop your own conference, or when you are so it just becomes the little software mogul in Indiana, I hope that you'll remember Scotty and maybe even me, and you'll invite us out to, I don't know, give a talk somewhere and buy us a corn dog or whatever the culinary specialty of Indiana is.
They did even better than that. They let me appear on IRQ Conflict last week.
They did?
They did.
Don't!
I think it's probably been released right now, but don't go and download it yet because you're listening to this. Right. Okay. Let's get on because we've been on air 28 minutes and we've not gone on to our feature segment. The reason that Mr. David Spector is with us, because we are going to talk about mixing being an indie and being a consultant. What problems does that cause? How does that allow us to focus on our software? What are the legal issues if we're writing code in one place we want to use elsewhere? So, John, it was you who came up with this, this subject. So you're to blame if nobody likes it. But of course, I will take the credit if they do for allowing it on the show. So, you introduced us to the subject, John. Why? What was it about this that made you want to bring it up?
Okay, well, because quite honestly, it's something I've been living. In my prior company, Webware, we were venture funded, and that's all great and wonderful, and grew to a nice large size. But when I decided to do Memory Miner, I didn't want to take that approach for lots of different reasons, and so I said, okay, well, if I need to do outside consulting, I will, and I have, and I find it both a challenge and also kind of quite enjoyable. It really just depends on what types of things you're working on. But what I found is that people who hire me as a consultant do so because of my experience, my kind of domain expertise in digital asset management, and my kind of platform experience with web applications, with iOS and with macOS, and so. If it's the case that a client hires you, to because of your expertise, then comes the question is, can you leverage work that you've already done? And the answer typically is yes. I mean, that's why they're hiring you in the first place. But the question is how, under what circumstances? And so that's really, I have my own experience. I have more than enough kind of tales to tell. But I thought it was sufficiently interesting that we should ask other people. And I just know from know that in the community there exist lots of different people who mix have some mixture of sales from software and sales from either consulting or some people who are indie developers, but they do it on the side. Yeah, and without kind of opening a can of worm about how you define indie and do you have to kind of make 100% of your living from software sales to be able to wear it, to get your indie badge, I think this is a worthy topic of discussion. So, Mr. Spector, what are your thoughts?
My thoughts, obviously, I think the same as yours, that this is a an interesting sort of field to be in for that, because it's one of the places where you're bringing something unique that, sort of the product of your work, presumably from, if you're purely an indie, from, your own indie practice. It's unlike, being a doctor or a lawyer. I mean, lawyers, in essence, about contract law, all that stuff is kind of pro forma. The thing about software development, of course, is that we're solving unique problems all the time. Hopefully we've learned eventually to abstract the things that we're doing into reusable frameworks and libraries. But unlike, the kind of, I don't want to say piecework, but the kind of monetizable work we see in other areas, it can be kind of hard to talk about, what those things are worth. So when you bring that stuff with you, you've got a whole bunch of problems you have to address. One is that, should you even be sort of broaching this with your clients? In other words, I think, sounds like from some of the work that you've done, your clients may have well asked you, but there's always this tension, do I bring something outside that I've done before with me? And what are the risks in that? Certainly, there's the risk of, is your code good enough to be used or seen by other people, right? How confident are you in your work product that, it's documented well and that it reads well and you're not going to get ridiculed by some smart-ass 22-year-old kid who thinks he knows better than you because he, he's newly out of school as opposed to us old dudes who've been around for a while. But once you get beyond that, then there are these interesting issues of, well, how do I price this? How do I license it? What does it mean, right? So I think you had mentioned that, you were sort of, in fact, we talked about this over dinner a few weeks ago. What were some of the things that you actually came up with in terms of thinking about licensing this? And then we can sort of share about, my experience in doing that as well, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are lots of different techniques. I mean, one technique that I've seen, and I think it's a very good one, is to be able to say, look, if you're going to bring code to the table, you should open source it, because then you've got a couple of advantages. And in fact, many people get jobs precisely because they do open source, and the theory is that, well, go to the source, go to the people who know the most about it. If you open source things in advance, then it makes things very, very clean. That just basically means that you're not trying to directly monetize the code that you're bringing to the table, and it kind of makes things a lot easier. If you do things where where you say, okay, I'm going to bring this code in an existing form, then the question comes in, are you going to try and charge it? And I think it's a slippery slope. I don't see how you could cleanly do it and saying, okay, well, this took me 10 hours to do it and you didn't pay me 10 hours to do it, so I'm going to bill you 10 hours for the time I took to do it. I don't really think you could take that approach. It's not tenable.
Really?
Well, I mean, I don't know, because it just becomes it's very, very tricky, I think, because it tends to add a bunch of kind of second guessing to what's in there, because they can say, well, you were going to do it anyway. You've used it. You've done it. It comes down to something that's unique about the nature of what we do, and that you can make digital copies of stuff that you've done. I mean, if you're an auto repair guy and you can only physically work on one car at a time, and you can't just instantly duplicate parts and use a part that you crafted for one repair job and instantly bring it into another. I mean, you can buy another one, but it's not quite the same, because right. So there is this whole gray area that's in there, and I think my concern is less about how do I monetize the thing that I've done, so much as make it clear that this is code that I've brought for it, whether it's open source or not. I don't want to encumber this code, because that's really what I'm more concerned about. When you sign an agreement, you typically say that this is a work for hire and they have every expectation, which means that you're supposed to give, if you're a conscientious developer, you write clean code, you have to always, when you make a check-in, you have to be able to say, if I get hit by a bus tomorrow, will they be able to go on without me? And if they can't, then I think that's a problem. You haven't done right by your client. But right. But it really comes down to the second part of most contracts, where you say, you know, that they it's an inventions agreement. They say if this is a work for hire, we own the IP for it. That's really where I feel the need to be able to come in and have addendums to my contract saying this is what I brought to the table. These are my prior this is my prior work, whether it's design work or actual code. And you know, here's a case where you know. You can make it fairly easy to distinguish between code you brought to the table just by virtue of having the different different prefix, right? So
sure. Well, I was actually taking a slightly different view, which is that I think that certainly your point about open using open source as a lever to say this is out there and I'm selling my expertise is one way to go. But I think that for a lot of developers, frankly, the body of one's work is something that in a way is proprietary, right? If you're an expert in something, you're an expert in digital asset management. Having too much things out there that are open source sort of cut you off of the knees, because then other people can become expert in your code and resell out from under you. But I think that in general, what we've, at least I've, in fact, I've sort of seen this in my past on Wall Street and elsewhere, is that in the 80s into the 90s, there were a lot of people who would go into companies as consultants. In essence, they'd sort of make a gravy train assignment for themselves. They'd make these packages and they'd, in essence, claim that since they were quasi-works for hire or they brought in their own code, that they would license them to the customer. And then the customer, in essence, would sort of be stuck into a contract where they are paying, in essence, forever to help keep this consultant employed to maintain the software. So until recently, I think, at least I've seen, that very few companies were willing to bring in developers who would bring in their own code bases for that reason. Yet, at the flip side, they have no problem with licensing the similar, development libraries, development tools, and so on from what they perceive to be really big corporations. And that partially talks to your point of, how is the code done? Is it maintainable? If the consultant were hit by a bus, who maintains this in the future, right? But now we're sort of in a different world. We have sort of hyper-specialization in what we do. So the general purpose tools that we buy from, whether it's Microsoft or Apple really isn't the software licensing game per se, but, pick your compiler company or your tools library company or your, programming library company, those are almost too general to actually get real work done that gives somebody a competitive advantage. So when a John Fox comes in with his asset management experience and offers to license a library, the question these days seems to me, anyway, and I sort of blogged a little bit about this, less about, gee, is this a gravy train thing, versus, gee, can we get some good license that adds value? And if the value is perceived high enough, almost all the doors can be opened. But then you have the sort of the dirty details, which is about the licensing. And to talk a little bit about that is really for consultants who want to, or indie developers who are also consulting who want to do that, I think the real thing is to, one, make sure your code has a very clear set of value propositions that adds, something really obvious to whatever it is your customer is doing. And then to make sure that, well, if you want to sell it outright, make sure you understand what you're doing. Because once you sell something, and you better be, one, happy with the price, and two, make sure your contract ensures that it's a non-exclusive use, because obviously if you really sell it, as in give it away for a certain amount of money, it's gone. They own it, you don't. Good night, nurse, you're done. But if you're really, really good, hopefully you're going to figure out a way to monetize whatever it is you're bringing. So it's in essence a software license, whether it's a license in perpetuity or a license with some kind of service contract, but also you then get to relicense that over and over again. So I guess to your previous point about, can you really come in and say this took me 100 hours and charge 100 hours for that value? Probably not. But what you can do is say, it's worth 50 hours or 75 hours, knowing that you're going to sell it this time to customer A, and clearly it has value and you should be able to remonetize that. And the way I sort of phrased that, actually in an article I wrote recently, actually after our last aborted attempt to get this one down, was that there's an old saying on Wall Street that bulls make money, bears make money, pigs get slaughtered, right? and the same thing applies to software, right? Which is that, if you try to monetize something too heavily all at once, well, people are going to say, that's nice, see ya. On the other hand, if you're smart about it and spread it out and figure out a way to make this an ongoing franchise, you'll probably do pretty well.
Well, I think you've hit the nail there. I mean, I pride myself on putting myself in other people's shoes. I mean, I think in life in general, that's a good way to do it. However you want to describe it, golden rule, however you like it. But, having hired engineers and worked with consultants and had employees and contract workers, you just have to treat people as you would like to be treated. And that's why I keep saying that, you have to be willing to make sure that your code is very well documented. You also have to carve out some time as part of your work of sitting down with the people that are there, who are your colleagues, and say, here's what I did. Here's the thinking behind it. you know, and so that you're sharing the knowledge, you know. So some people would say, but then you're giving away the secret sauce. It's like, no, you're not. You know, my feeling is if you're really good, you'll always be able to come up with more. I mean, and you risk nothing. I don't think you risk nothing. I think by being good. Yeah, maybe that's
well,
naive.
I agree. I mean, but I think one of the things we've seen, though, at least I've seen it in larger corporations, is that there is a willingness to take advantage of the incredible generosity of the open source community, and in fact to use it against them at some level. There are companies that have gone and closed source, in essence forked open source code, and then use their marketing leverage to then in essence shut out other people from using it. And that becomes problematic. But in general, I think you're exactly right, that obviously there's nothing new under the sun. There isn't really a secret sauce. But it really depends on what your business model is, what your goals are, and frankly, how specialized the code is.
Well, I think that's interesting, you know, because it is true, I think, that at least for what I'm doing, it is fairly specialized, but it's not all that specialized. I mean, what are my areas of expertise? Is dealing with metadata and services around digital media. And, you know, it's my proven track record that makes me attractive to certain customers. But I think it also comes back to what your intent is. You know, is your goal to be able to be, you know, a gun for hire 100 times, or, you know, back to why we started this conversation. I do this as a way to be able to you know, support the development of Memory Miner. And in fact, you know, I came from the enterprise software world where you know, the decision to buy something or not hinges on a lot of different things: quality of the technology, longevity of the company providing it, you know, cost for ownership and getting things up and run, that type of thing. But in general, enterprise software is not known for being, you know, having beautiful user experiences. And what added value to that existing experience I have is having done consumer software for a number of years. And there, if people are going to, you know, spend their own money and spend their own time to use it, it lives or dies based on the quality of the user experience. And so, you know, but on the other hand, a lot of consumer software doesn't typically have to scale in the way that enterprise software does. So, you know, For me personally, I enjoy doing a little bit of both. I mean, if when I was working on Memory Miner, you know, with doing nothing else but sitting in a cafe for just about a year, which is the amount of time it took me to get version 1.0 out the door, and I didn't do any outside consulting. Then you release it, you get this kind of euphoria, you got this product, it's out there, and so on and so forth. But it's kind of like, you know, if you had to eat the same meal every day, you know, you'd be a little bit bored. So I actually enjoy working on other challenges that are at least in the ballpark, that are related to what I do, because I think that it helps, you know, cross-pollinate your areas of expertise. What you learn from enterprise scaling and stuff, you can apply to consumer stuff. What you learn about nice user experiences, you can bring into the enterprise world. So for me, it's very nice. And I, you know, the thing I enjoy about being an indie, however you define that, is being able to work on different types of things and not being stuck doing one thing exclusively.
Oh, exactly. I couldn't agree more. You know, there is, you know, beyond even the sort of just getting out there, there's the cross-pollination, but there's also getting your head unstuck from just what you're doing and realizing that there are people out there who might have opinions on what you're doing that could influence you. You know, being heads down on a lot of software for the last couple of years, you know, it's interesting to see that, you know, my perception of what's actually going on in the world might be kind of different than the real world out there. So, you know, it's almost like meetups. You know, it's one thing to be an indie developer or even an enterprise developer, but you also have to get out of your shell. So that cross-pollination and that interaction is certainly a good thing.
Yep. Scotty, you're staying conspicuously silent. You want to bring in some opinions from the board?
I was just seeing how long I could not say anything for on my own show, really. See the record.
Yeah, but don't forget the video's on there, and we can hear you cracking the beer open in the background.
That's why I was browsing Amazon, actually. but I'm sure
hey,
I heard
hey,
what
John,
you just
actually,
said.
Just back to the. It just occurred to me something I'd written actually in one of my blog posts about this. It just occurred to me. So, in your experience, because a number of people commented to me actually in the EU that they don't feel the need to do this, have you ever felt the need to get errors and omissions insurance when you're doing this kind of development just to make sure some crazy client doesn't sue you into oblivion?
No, I haven't. And now that you mention it, maybe I should be afraid. But I think it depends on the industry you're in. I can definitely see why Wall Street, where there's tons and tons of money. I mean, the type of work I've done for have been – haven't been the type of kind of, let's say, high-flying thing. So, I mean, if I were doing it for a bunch of lawyers or doing it for financial services, I probably I feel I definitely would. For the type of media-oriented companies that I've been doing work for, I haven't really felt the need. I would say, though, that if looking into it further, somebody points me out, it's like, hey, here's some insurance that really does work or is valid, you know, and it doesn't cost an arm and a leg, I probably would, just for that added, for what insurance is for, that kind of peace of mind.
Yeah, no, I've had it for a number of years, and I always thought it was like, oh, come on, you know, who really needs this? And just sort of the litigiousness, you know, certainly Wall Street is bad enough, but I had a couple of friends back in New York who had been doing some media work. I think won't mention the company they're working for, but it's a very large media company, and they're working on an embedded system. And through no fault of their own, something went a little crazy, and the company decided to sue all the contractors. And the people who didn't have E&O insurance were very sad because they wound up spending a lot of money out of pocket. And it was like $1,000 a year for like $2 million worth of insurance, which, you know, it seems like a lot of money. But I guess at the end of the day, it depends on how much someone's suing you for.
But that's just a welcome to America, isn't it? I mean, when I was consulting initially, or for a number of contracts, I had to take out insurance, and there was a big tick box that said, do you plan on doing work for any clients in the USA? And the moment you tick that box, the cost of your insurance sort of quadrupled. Because basically, wow. No one expected you to get sued in Europe or in England. But the moment you put anything to do with the USA down, they just expected your ass to get sued. And therefore, you better start paying some serious money. Which was quite interesting.
The only bright side to all that is, at least over here, it's tax deductible. It's a business expense.
Yeah, it is here as well. But it was a lot of money. And the only other one that they really hit you for is if you did any work for the airline industry, especially if it's air traffic control. That was quite expensive to insure.
I can imagine.
So I mean, it's I find it hard because I should imagine that most indies out there have had to sort of wrestle with the subject of continue to consult, or maybe even staying in a permanent position, which obviously, what are you doing? Do they cross over works in there? I have to say, when I go work for a client now, I try and have a non-exclusive loose license on anything I write. In other words, they get to keep all the source code, but also I can get to use it as well. And if they're prepared to do that, then I'm prepared to use any source code I have in my library, and they pay whatever cost it costs me to integrate it into their system. They don't actually pay for the source code, because I know that anything I write for them that will be useful, I can keep for myself and work elsewhere. If they're not willing to take that type of license, then they don't get access to any of the source code in my library, and they have to pay me to write it. And that most small clients, you know, that works well, because they have no objection to using it again, especially if you say, yeah, you know, I will not use it in a competing system. I mean, I think that's only fair to the client, especially if they're trying to produce something, you know, you're sort of being subcontracted to produce a piece of software to sell. But most small clients are very just open with that. I think it's only when you move into the corporate world that all this, oh no, we must own, or you can't do this, or whatever else, becomes a real big issue. So the secret is, work for small clients.
Yeah,
I suppose that's an interesting question, though, because as you pointed out, that, you know, there are varying flavors of indies, right? There are people who fancy themselves indies, yet they really have full-time jobs, and their indie life is kind of the part-time thing they hope to make full-time. So for people in that boat, I think that we should point out that it really is probably pretty important that they check out their employment agreements, because there are some states, at least here in the U.S., for example, Texas, where things you do even off hours. There was a very famous case settled in Texas that for a programmer who had an idea, he wanted to quit and basically exercise this idea. The company sued him, and it went all the way up to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court said that employment agreement was valid, such that any ideas that that particular guy had in Texas belonged to his employer no matter what. Here in the state of California, we're relatively lucky in that your employer, I believe, can only claim ownership to ideas that are relevant and germane to your job, and things you do outside of your job belong to you. So that's another thing, that if you are doing outside consulting, make sure you know what side of the lines you're on, so that you don't find yourself in an uncomfortable position.
Well, that's very good point to bring up. What I was going to say earlier is that we said at the top of the segment that, you know, Apple tends to appeal to people who look at computing as a means to an end. You know, they want to whatever, tell stories, so they like photography, so they buy software for doing that. And I think that if you do consulting work, and you're doing it for a company that is a where software is you know, a means to an end. It's a business tool for them. That the company has a different way of looking at it than, I don't know, if you're doing it for, say, if you are a subcontractor to a company whose job is contracting out software engineering or providing, you know, custom development solutions, kind of, I don't want to call it chop shop, but somewhere along those lines. So I think that the way that they look at contracts would vary.
True.
What else can we say about this, Mr. Scotty?
Oh, you're expecting me now to jump in? You've just run out of things to say, and you want me to...
No, I could keep waffling on forever. It's your show. Just rent time on it.
You haven't got forever. You've got about 5 more minutes, and then we're going to pull this thing to a close, because I have a schedule to keep, you know. I think the lesson I would say is don't assume anything. I think the points that David just made about if you're an employee, I've heard lots of people get caught by the fact that the IP on any code you write at any time, as long as you're under an employment contract, belongs to somebody else. I'm not convinced that would stand up in a court, but who really wants to spend days in court fighting that against larger corporations? I think if you're an indie, you just need to ask these questions straight away at the front. Don't leave it a chance. Don't guess. Don't wait for the small print in a contract to get you. Just, you know, when you walk through the door, I think have this discussion. And often I think the fact that you're even prepared to have this discussion shows you're professional. And it's not, you know, maybe you think it's going to scare people away that, oh, okay, he hasn't even got the contract yet and he's wanting to know how he can make money elsewhere or whatever else. I think sometimes the fact that you raise these issues, people actually often haven't thought of them, and you get clarification and everyone gets agreement, and it's often not that complicated. Work on the basis that most people are reasonable. It's only when I say working for the really big companies where there's legal departments and whatever else that, you know, maybe there you're in more trouble. But personally, I try not to work for those companies anyway.
There you go. Well, you know, another interesting thing that I've found is very, very helpful, and it's one of these things that I guess if you're licensing your source code, or either outright or you know, licensing it as a library, is that make sure that you're very clear with your client or your customer about, in essence, what kind of warranty you're providing on the code, and your willingness, either as a consulting, you know, future consulting operation, or you know, part of the contract, or even just out of your goodwill, to make sure that you're available to maintain it at a level where, you know, if they have problems, they can call on you to help. Because there's nothing worse than, of course, having some critical piece of your software, and maybe either your software had a bug that you didn't know about, or maybe just the project has evolved to the point where whatever library you've given them or leased them or lent them or whatever it is now needs to be updated in some way, that you can be available to help them, even if you're not getting paid for it, because it engenders goodwill, and you've then got a client who's willing to say, you know, John worked for us 4 years ago, we licensed this product, and we just updated the software, and there's some things that need to be updated, and he was willing to come in and help us, and man, what a great consultant, and he's a member of our family, even though, you know, we hadn't worked together in a while, and he was a great guy. So there's a goodwill, a good karma factor, I think, that has to go along with bringing your code into anything, that you don't, even if it's, you know, several years down the line, you don't want to abandon it.
I'm going to sort of disagree with you there. If they've got the code, it's their problem. If you've given it to them without the code, then you have probably you need to make sure you have a contractual and a moral responsibility to not leave them hanging with code that won't run anymore or whatever else. But if they've got the source code, this whole coming in and doing the fix for free.
Be willing to advise them.
Yeah, I think what actually happens is you get into that point where they're saying, well, last time you did it for free. And I've been caught too many times that way. And actually, I found that the relationship with a client has gone downhill. And in some ways, it's worth charging. Even if you charge less, make the point of charging to say that actually, you know, this is work that needs doing. It's work that needs doing because the life has moved on. Systems have moved on. Operating systems have moved on, whatever. Because once you start doing something for free, when you next charge them for something, they resent it.
I agree with that. I mean, I probably was formulating that as I was saying it. I think that, you know, at the end of the day, I think you're right. I think, you know, there is a goodwill aspect. I think I try very hard to keep with my clients so that, you know, certainly, you know, if it's 5 years, I don't think I'm going to go and do something for free. I think if they said, hey, you know, we were using X, Y, and Z, could you give us some advice? I might give them an hour of my time, but obviously if there's some serious amount of work needs to be done, I hopefully we're all grown-ups and they realize that, you know, my time isn't free, their time isn't free. But I think what I would like to do, like to imagine that I do, hopefully, is engender some level of goodwill where I'm a good guy, not a pushover, but definitely a good guy and willing to, you know, to at least lend an ear and help out where I can.
I think your willingness to do the fix and do the changes within a couple of days of being asked and not having to wait weeks or months to do it engenders just as much goodwill as doing it for free and creates less problems.
Okay. Well, I think there's a hybrid thing. I mean, I definitely see the points brought by you and Jeppy and Uli in the chat room that, you know, you have to be very clear about it. But I also agree with Dave that long term, you know, goodwill is actually a term that's used in contractual law, isn't it? I mean, that's when you buy a company, part of what you're buying is goodwill, your reputation. And I think that you can do something. You can say, look, you know, if somebody comes along and 3 years after you wrote something and somebody's saying, hey, you know, we have to make the decision, you know, should we bring this code forward? Should we consider redoing it? I think I don't think you lose anything by saying, all right, fine, you know, I'll give you an hour of my time, but it's going to be over a very nice lunch at a cool place of my choosing. In which case, you can kind of talk through some of the issues. Because, I mean, here are some concrete scenarios. You know, a lot of Objective-C developers have libraries of category classes. You know, everybody has them. And I think everybody by now, if you've been doing it long enough, has been through the experience of, you know, why do you create a category? It's because something was missing in Apple-supplied code and you added it. So at some point, let's say you have a collection of category classes and three or four of them have now been replaced by implementations done by Apple, which are either better or at least equivalent. Is there some value? But it's part of a library and you need to bring that forward because you want to port it to a new system. At that point, it's kind of a hybrid approach. You may decide, hey, I can get rid of some of this code. Over time, I think it's desirable to get rid of code that's not needed anymore. I think spending a little bit of time, being willing to, at a high level, and give some indication about what may be needed, you have a chance to do three things. One, get a good meal if you're clever about where you do it, which is why I always insist on having my meetings at French Laundry. secondly, you get a chance to build up good karma by being willing to give some advice. And third, you have a chance to be a good salesman saying, hey, you know, I think that the right approach to do is for you to invest some additional time. I'd be happy to do the work for you. And I think that, you know, if you have a good relationship and a good reputation, they're going to want to hire you. So you can kind of, you know, bridge the divide here between being very hardcore saying, look, you've got the source code, your problem, you know, and being somebody who has a good reputation and thinks in a way that will benefit all parties and not just kind of say it's absolutely me against them and kind of going from a girded loin perspective.
Well, this one's really stirred up the chat room. There's a good discussion going on, and I'm afraid because of timing, we're going to have to leave the chat room to do it. So I'm just going to give you and David time to prepare your final closing bios and come love what I'm doing stuff. Well, we'll just quickly talk about next week.
Gather around people wherever you roam.
Yes, we have been listening to our iDeveloper Live audience. More tech, you shouted. More tech. More tech. So as of next week, there will be more tech. We're restructuring the show into distinct segments. We're going to have our news and views segment. We're going to have our indie business segment because we get a lot of requests for indie business stuff. And yes, the tech segment. So that's of next week when we start broadcasting live. There's going to be more tech. We listen, there's going to be more tech. Let me say that one more time. There will be more tech. And just in case you didn't get that, what will there be next week, John?
More tech, because the times, they are a-changing.
They are, and I'm probably going to stop that before I get sued now.
there we are. So the big question is did Dylan have a maintenance contract for
him? Aren't those called royalties?
That's payback for the coding I did. So yeah, we're gonna try and yes, Uli's got it. More tech, more tech, more tech. That's right, because everybody loves more tech. So that's next week. So tune in to see that. So, John, tell people where they can find more of your wisdom and who you are.
Well, they know who you are. More about you, I mean.
Well, if I do develop some wisdom in the future, I will be sure to put it on memoryminer.com/blog. So memoryminer.com is my product, Memory Miner, where you can read all about it. Memoryminer.com/blog is where I talk mostly about developing Memory Miner and some of the ideas behind it and where I want to go with it. And on Twitter, I'm available as Djembe, D-J-E-M-B-E, like the West African drum that I enjoy playing.
And David, it's been great having you on the show. I think you did even better this week than last week. Not that anyone else out there is able to compare, because they don't know what you did last week. So they'll just have to trust me. But I'm sure people want more of your wisdom and your skill and your expertise and your silky ideas. So let them know where they can find them.
Oh, from your mouth to God's ear, thank you so much. Well, thank you again for having me again. And this time we have enough recordings to populate the entire internet with our voices. I can be found, my personal blog is at my personal site, which is Zeitgeist, I'll spell that, Zeitgeist.com, which is not ridiculously frequently updated. But my big project these days, in addition to working on a lot of contract iOS software, is a little site called MacIndie, MacIndie.com. And MacIndie is designed to be a resource for indie Mac and iOS developers. And the idea behind it is I'm trying to showcase a lot of interesting software that people in this incredibly generous community are producing and help people figure out if they're just starting their indie adventure, how they can get going. Tips and tricks and things that basics that you need to know, everything from, I think I posted up in the chat room, sourcing the single consultant, with apologies to Helen Gurley Brown, to getting yourself going, things like source code management and how to save yourself time in your development. And I can be found at Twitter at @DHMSpectre. And thank you again for having me. It's been an honor, a privilege, and an awful lot of fun.
That was a comprehensive bio. I am impressed. Was that off the top of your head, or were you reading that?
No, it was off the top of my head. Ask John. I can natter on for hours.
I am even more impressed now.
Even without benefit of substances.
Right. Indeed. Well, we have run over the hour, which is, I guess I don't need to apologize for, because we're on the internet and we've not made any other program late. But I'm Scotty from iDeveloper TV. You can follow my rantings on Twitter by following MacDevNet. But more importantly, follow Developers Against Poverty by following Devs Against Pov. Visit developersagainstpoverty.org. Get your hand in your pocket. Get out your wallet. Give some cash. Come up with something creative. Let me know what you're doing. There'll be a place on the site to register that you're a part of the whole thing. There'll be logos to download and link to. All coming up next week, 1st of Feb, developersagainstpoverty.org. But until next time, from all of us here at iDeveloper Live, you take care. We'll be right back.